High 73 inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. Rain still to the west of us, moving in our direction. Right now, 53 Kenosha, 50 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
We are turning the clock back today on the morning show, just over a quarter of a century, the year 1999, and that happens to be the title of a fascinating new book called 1999, The Year Low Culture Conquered America and Kickstarted Our Bizarre Times. It is the contention of the author of this book, Ross Benish, that much of what we see in modern America today, in modern culture, in society, in the way we interact with one another and the world, including in the political arena, can be at least to some extent traced to some of what sort of exploded in popularity in the late 1990s and especially in the year 1999. And he explores a number of different facets of popular culture in a really discerning way. And Ross Benish brings to the task his ability and experience and talent as a journalist whose work has appeared in Rolling Stone, Wall Street Journal, Esquire magazine, Entertainment Weekly, among many other places. He has several books to his credit, including Rural Rebellion, How Nebraska Became a Republican Stronghold, a book about which we discussed on the morning show. And again, this latest book, which is published by University Press of Kansas, is 1999, The Year Low Culture Conquered America and Kickstarted Our Bizarre Times. Ross Benish, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hey, it's great to be here.
One maybe personal matter we should kind of get out of the way. It's not deeply personal by any means, but help our listeners understand who you were, where you were in life in 1999, and to what extent that first-person experience figures rather prominently in this book, or I should say maybe shapes some of your perspectives about what you talk about.
It definitely shapes my perspective because I was a fan of everything that is covered in the book. All the stuff that was pretty trashy in the 90s was what I grew up with. So in 1999, I was 10 years old, living in a village of 300 people in Nebraska, and I watched Jerry Springer with my parents. I listened to the Insane Clown Posse with my friends. I watched pro wrestling. Everyone my age had some sort of Pokemon product. I had Beanie Babies in my room. I played video games. So those are all topics of the culture that I cover in the book. And, you know, I don't try to hide that my experience with these products at first was as a fan. And what I argue is that it helps you understand why some of these things were popular. Because, you know, stuff like Jerry Springer and the Insane Clown Posse in particular receive a lot of mockery and are often looked down upon, but I get why they appeal to people because I was among the people who was, you know, buying them or tuning in.
When did you, or under what circumstances did you begin to realize that all of these interesting lines could be drawn between some of these cultural phenomena in the late 1990s and where we are in 2025? I mean, or have you made those connections for a long, long time, or was there some particular light bulb above the head moment where you realized that those events, those big successes in that era have sort of lasting resonance to this very day? When and how did you make that connection?
Yeah, So I started to make the connection almost 10 years ago, like 2015, 2016. I would just see these little, it was like a bunch of little moments. You know, you would see like political infighting that resembled the Jerry Springer show, or you would see like, I remember like BP dumped a lot of oil in the ocean, and the way they were trying to sell a story of them being environmentally conscious reminded me a lot of like a pro wrestling angle of the 90s, like where you're suspending disbelief so that people get to buy a storyline. And I would just notice these little things, like all the crypto hype was reminding me of the Beanie Babies speculation, where you have an asset that inflates in price just because people think it's the gotta have thing, but it's not actually worth anything, and then it plummets. But I put the project off for a while because I wrote Rural Rebellion, which we talked about on your show a few years ago, and I felt that was like an important book to write at that time. So I put this on the back burner, and then I came back to it after I completed Rural Rebellion. But all those things I noticed only got crazier. Like the Jerry Springer moments in our national politics became so obvious. With wrestling everywhere, I mean, if you know, Trump is a pro wrestling Hall of Famer. The week of his the week that he was reelected, he was on the Undertaker's podcast, and Linda McMahon is his nominee for Secretary of Education. So these things of the 90s have come back in a big way, and you know, 90s nostalgia is really in right now. So I wanted to look at like the aspect that gets a little less attention, and that's given some intellectual depth to the trashiest aspects of the decade.
Right. And one of the things I appreciate early on in the book is that you are careful to remind us that for all that you talk about in your book that you know, we might think of as low culture or trash or you know, whatever you want to see, that this was not the entire picture, that when we look at 1999, we're also looking at films like The Sixth Sense and Toy Story 2 and The Matrix, and we're looking at TV shows like West Wing and some of the great towering successes of must-see TV and so on. So, I mean, it's easy once we kind of get to talking about this to think that all that was happening in 1999 are these sort of wild, crazy things that are the focus of your book. But I appreciate the fact that you take the time to just say that isn't the whole thing. And as we're reading your book, we might otherwise really easily fall into that trap of thinking that, oh my gosh, 1999 was nothing but a big cultural garbage dump. Far from it, actually.
Oh, definitely far from it. There were, like you said, critically acclaimed, some of the best TV shows and movies ever made. Chris Rock was doing awesome in comedy. You know, there were like an Interpreter of Maladies and Harry Potter books. I mean, there were a lot of things in pop culture that still resonate with people today in a very powerful way. You know, I didn't cover those things because there have been so many books about them already. Like there's a, you know, another good book with the title 1999 that makes the case that it was actually the greatest year of cinema of all time because of the movies you mentioned, like Sixth Sense and The Matrix and American Beauty and many others. But I wanted to look at a very specific aspect of the 90s, the trashy stuff. And I don't view that as like a bad thing. You know, I think even fans of Jerry Springer would say, well, that was pretty trashy, but we still like it. So I embrace that aspect. But yeah, you know, I've read books before where they'll have a thesis and they'll act like everything revolves around that and kind of ignore everything else. So I just wanted to call out that alongside pro wrestling being the top show on cable and Jerry Springer being the top show of daytime and ICP having two platinum records that year, you know, you also had the birth of the Sopranos and a lot of, you know, pop culture that people try to imitate today in an artistic way.
Absolutely. And so we should mention that your book explores cultural phenomena like Jerry Springer, the explosion of popularity, in sense the expansion of the world of pro wrestling, some ways in which porn became widely distributed with videos like Girls Gone Wild, and also the way in which video games surged in a way that they never had before. This and other things are explored in your book. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Ross Benesch, whose new book is called 1999, The Year Low Culture Conquered America and Kickstarted Our Bizarre Times. I think before we dig into some of the specifics in terms of these different phenomena, we should talk a little bit about some of the ways in which this all sort of sprang into being or exploded in popularity for some really good reasons. That is, it's no accident that all of these things started to sort of explode at the same time, that there were certain things going on, some involving deregulation, some involving new technologies, that all sort of helped to nurture the phenomenon that we will then talk about. Explain what was going on in the late 1990s that, in a sense, kickstarted all of this, to steal a word from your subtitle.
Yeah. So the deregulation, I'll start with that first. This kind of started in the 80s, but it really kicked up throughout the 90s. There were a lot of media deregulation. So like in the 80s under Reagan, he eliminated the cap of commercial minutes per hour that a TV station could run. So TV shows like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which were basically commercials for a toy, weren't counted as commercial time. Like, they didn't count against the cap. So you could start running those shows. You could also start running infomercials. So Girls Gone Wild, all the Miss Cleo stuff, that's popular because of deregulation. It wouldn't even have been allowed on television prior to Reagan. Now, you also get into areas where back in the day, there used to be a lot of separations between like TV networks, movie studios, cable operators. They all had to be separate companies. Like a TV network couldn't be owned by a company that also had a movie studio, and a TV network couldn't produce most of their own primetime programming. All these were regulations put in place mostly in the 70s. Those were all gone by like the mid-90s. So when you eliminate those, suddenly TV networks can be owned by, you know, you have these huge giant corporations that start to put together all these different pieces that they couldn't before. So Viacom has TV networks, they have movie studios, they have book publishing, they have video rental. So they could take one IP, like Howard Stern, and make him super popular. They could publish his book, they could do his radio show, they could do his TV show. That wasn't, you know, really allowed before. Reality TV comes from deregulation because the networks, once they're allowed to produce their own shows and share them across their widening portfolio and their huge conglomerate, the concept of reality TV, of making something very cheap to distribute broadly, becomes very appealing. Before, they had to rely on syndicated talk shows, but now they're kind of making their own talk shows and putting them out there. And Viacom, which merged with CBS, was a huge proponent of making reality TV what it is today. You know, after that merger, they took what was popular on MTV in the real world, and they put on The Amazing Race and Survivor and Big Brother on CBS. And, you know, after that, reality TV is super mainstream. And then the Telecommunications Act in 1996 is probably the biggest single deregulation that allowed everyone to get in everyone's business. So phone companies could become cable companies could offer phone service. Basically, across the telecommunications industry, everyone could do everything. And these conglomerates just got so big that suddenly AT&T, through its video rental business and through its online business, becomes actually the biggest revenue generator of the porn industry. That's only possible through deregulation. And then the technology is all these things are becoming interconnected, while the rules governing who can own what become less restrictive. And you have cable getting more popular. Internet is coming into its own, so you have more places where you can place content. So cheap content that reaches the masses is what's like sought after by these huge corporations. Jerry Springer, pro wrestling, you know, reality TV, especially the porn. Those are all things that are produced very cheaply, but have mass appeal.
Right. And if I can just jump in for a second, because I know you have more thoughts, but I just want to say that one of the things that really occurred to me as I read this part of the book, and when we're talking about making things cheaply and cheap mass entertainment and so on, I think most of us, when we first read those words, we mostly think about entertainment that doesn't cost very much money. And, of course, that's probably the most fundamental way in which this was cheap entertainment. But I think only after reading your book did I start to make the connection that cheap entertainment is also so very often cheap in the more subjective way as well. It's not just about dollars and cents, but cheap the way we sometimes use that term to describe something that has little, if any, redeeming value or social value. Because, I mean, if it's cheap right from the start, if it doesn't represent a significant outlay of resources and so on, then it in a sense you're given tacit permission to just sort of throw it together and not worry about, I mean, does this help people? Does this benefit society? Does this teach us lessons? Does this elevate the human condition? I mean those questions are almost ludicrous in this kind of environment where it's all about just churning out things that are really cheap. And all of that ends up being cheap, not only in terms of dollars and cents, but cheap in other kinds of value. Or at least some of us curmudgeons on the outside looking in would probably talk about it in those terms.
I mean, that makes sense to me. If you look at the Jerry Springer show, they made over 4,000 episodes over the course of like 30 years. But 4,000 episodes, you forget about them. Even when they're outrageous, you forget about a particular episode almost by the time you're done watching it. It's just another entry into the catalog. It's not like watching, you know, to take another example from 1999, it's not like watching like a very expensive, well-produced Sopranos episode that leaves an impression on you that you can recall that specific episode a year later and talk about it with people. With Jerry Springer, you know, it's just one outrage episode after another that very much was thrown together. If you watch the documentary that was released by Netflix this month, those producers were just throwing together shows sometimes the day of because they're under pressure to produce a lot of content on a short budget. So it's all over the place almost by design, which, you know, that's with us in other ways now too. If you look at social media posts, that's the cheapest produced content and probably the least enriching that there is on the planet.
I suspect that beyond the matter of deregulation and breakthroughs of technology, you also want to say a word about the way in which so much entertainment seemed to tilt towards young people, towards a younger and younger audience, which of course would very much dictate the kind of choices were made. Tell us about that and why that occurred.
Well, so in the late 90s, there were more teens spending more money than there ever had been before. There were actually more teens in the 90s than there were during the baby boom of the previous generation. And they had a lot of disposable income, or at least had a lot of access to their parents' disposable income. So Disney and Viacom and these other, you know, giant companies spent a huge amount of resources trying to appeal to that young demographic, because the idea, if you're a marketer, is if you can hook someone while they're young, they have a lot of lifetime value to your brand. You know, if you get a 20-year-old person into your entertainment product or into your soda brand, they can contribute to your bottom line for another 70 years. There's a lot less marketing being done to 70-year-olds because, you know, the amount of time that they're going to contribute to your bottom line is much more finite. So all of these products that I'm talking about not only were produced cheap, but they were aimed at young people and primarily at young men. There were a lot of assumptions in the 90s about men still controlling purchasing decisions. If you looked at who was producers of primetime TV shows, it was like 80% men. And, you know, it's still mostly men today, but the extent of it is a little less. So young people, especially young men, were the prime audience for these conglomerates, and that's like why Howard Stern was so popular. That helped Tom Green become super popular. The Man Show launched. You know, pro wrestling, a lot of these talk shows, even especially Jerry Springer, had a very heavy young man audience. In the 90s, the share of pop culture that was directed at males like 18 to 35 was much higher than it was today, and that contributes to it being trashier.
Right. Well, and of course, again, if you are not part of that demographic yourself, then you just tear out your hair in frustration, if not horror, at the way things are turning. I love the quote you include from Stanley Kaufman in The New Republic, saying, talking specifically about movies, but this could apply to a lot of things. Now there's a sense that teenage fingers are gripping the film world's windpipe. I mean, it's like it's the youngsters who are in charge, at least in terms of the kind of movies that are going to be made, the kind of music that'll be sung at halftime at the Super Bowl, the TV shows, and you know, on and on and on,
and the fashion, and yep,
absolutely. For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Ross Benish about his latest book, which is called 1999, The Year Low Culture Conquered America and Kickstarted Our Bizarre Times. The book takes a look at some of the most significant cultural phenomenon that either emerged in the late 1990s or exploded in popularity or maybe expanded in terms of their scope and outreach, and the book argues that much of what we are experiencing today can be traced back to some of what was going on there. And by the way, I don't think we've yet mentioned, or maybe we have, but let's say it again if we have, that 1999 is also the year of the emergence of TiVo, and perhaps even more significantly Napster, which really helps to kind of rewrite people's thinking about what we have a right to and what we have to pay for.
And 1999 was the emergence of Netflix, even though it was a mail order video service at the time. So, you know, when I talked about technology earlier, I was mostly referring to porn and other digital technologies, but the concept of file sharing, of copyright, of uploading other people's content was radically changed. You started to have on-demand viewing thanks to TiVo. And even though Napster ultimately shuttered due to court cases, its influence lived on because all those piracy sites copied it. That all started in 1999. So it was a huge year for changes in media distribution.
Mm. Well, let's start.
Oh, you know what the first show was recorded on TiVo?
The show we're going to talk about right now, the Jerry Springer Show.
Yep.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting to think about the people who nowadays, young people, how unlikely they are to perhaps recognize the name Jerry Springer or to know very much about what made him once upon a time one of the most famous people on television, and yet his legacy is certainly very, very lasting. I think a lot of us, even those of us who kind of despised what he did, certainly have a very vivid memory of who he was. But for anybody listening who would be largely unaware of Jerry Springer and his significance, explain the way in which he dramatically rewrote the rules of daytime television.
So when Jerry Springer first began as a talk show host, he was the former mayor of Cincinnati, been on the city council. He'd been a TV anchor. He tried to be a serious talk show, more like Donahue. He would interview Oliver North and Jesse Jackson. He'd talk about team homelessness. He would try to be a talk show that was about issues. And viewers did not like that. The show was going to get canceled. It was one of the lowest rated talk shows of the 90s. So they put him on super late hour, and he got a new executive producer, Richard Dominic, and they basically said, well, you have, you know, a few weeks to turn the show around, do whatever you want. And they just went crazy. They went young. That's what they tried to do. They tried to get a young audience. They wanted it to be so crazy that when you were flipping the station, even if your TV was muted, you would just see the image of what was going on in the description below of the episode title and say, you know, what is that? I got to watch that. You know, it's KKK members fighting black activists. It's teenage strippers and all sorts of incestuous love triangles, a man marrying his horse, you know, self-castration, adults in diapers. They had just outrageousness. There was no rhyme or reason other than it has to be outrageous and shocking to be in the Jerry Springer Show.
Right.
The audience loved it.
Right. You quote an executive producer of the show saying, if you're looking to save the whales, call Oprah. If you're sleeping with a whale, call us. And that kind of in a nutshell sort of sets the stage for the kind of craziness that ensued on that program. Your book reminds us that before Jerry Springer, there, of course, was one Geraldo Rivera, whom many of us will remember, but a lot of people not so much. But in some ways, he does not live on in infamy in the way that Jerry Springer does. What is it that Jerry Springer did that was above and beyond what Geraldo Rivera did before him?
Well, so Jerry Springer didn't dial it back. So there was a murder on the Jenny Jones Show in the 90s where one guest murdered another guest after their taping because essentially there was a gay man who had a crush on a straight acquaintance, and he revealed that in the show, and then the straight guy murdered the gay guest. Days later, it was a huge scandal. He went to prison. Jenny Jones was sued by the family of the victim, and they won, although it was eventually overturned in court. And it was just a huge media circus. And all the other talk shows after that murder kind of toned it down. They did less of the, like, shocking, like, gotcha scenarios where you'd bring someone on and you would shock them about something that happened to them or their family. So they had less of those surprises. Jerry Springer did not tone down. They kept doing the same crazy show that they had been doing. And so they stood out from their peers for a while for being more outrageous and for being unapologetic. So that separates them from Geraldo. And then Geraldo pivoted. He didn't stay with the talk show format as long as Jerry Springer did. He's done a bunch of other things, including political commentary. So Geraldo very much helped pioneer that format. But Jerry Springer was still doing his talk show like in the 2010s. He did it almost all the way up till his death. So he remained the king of sleaze for being on that throne for a long time.
Right. And you remind us of something that most of us have blessedly forgotten by now. And that was that one of the best-selling video releases in this time was a video recording called Jerry Springer, Too Hot for TV. Explain what this extraordinarily popular video recording was all about.
So Jerry Springer, Too Hot for TV was made by the same people who made Cops outtakes. And what you're basically doing, Cops, the TV show, the Fox show. So what you're doing is you're taking clips that are cutting room floor material, or sometimes they may have profanity or nudity that wouldn't allow it to be aired on broadcast TV, and you put them on a VHS tape of like a two-hour compilation, and you run a ton of commercials with a 1-800 number that you got to give a credit card for, and people go bananas for it. You're basically taking the trash that you can't even air, and you're turning it into a new product. I liken it to Hormel Foods would take the scrap meat and turn it into Spam, and that became a huge bestseller. This is the Spam of daytime television. And Too Hot for TV, the commercials were just inescapable. It was like, do you want more nudity and fights and all this other stuff that's outrageous on the Jerry Springer? We're going to give it to you in a more extreme form. So a guy in our town, my brother's friend, my brother's 7 years older than me, his friend Todd got the VHS. I assume he used his mom's credit card, and we thought it was awesome. Like, we would bring the VHS to like a different household each day, so I'd watch it with my brother's friends, and then like the neighbors would have it, and that Too Hot for TV made it around our village of 300 people. Everyone just took turns borrowing it because we were so excited about the promos for it. But when you actually watched it, there was like a little bit of nudity and a little bit more extreme fighting than you had on there, which appealed to fans of Jerry Springer like us. But a lot of it just wasn't very good. You understood why they didn't air it in the first place. It wasn't very captivating. The stories weren't original. It's not really worth $20, but millions of people bought it, and it was the hottest like VHS order of the late 90s. They sold millions of copies, and it helped them expand their merchandise significantly.
Right, and it was sort of crowd mentality, of like a lemmings flocking off of a cliff. I mean, and of course, this is before the internet is even absolutely supreme. And that's one of the most interesting things too, the way the public would go after these things and the craze that surrounded what Vogue magazine called a TV show of nuts and sluts. I mean, it's really interesting. So what are the lines that you would draw between that and where we see pop culture today? What are the most significant lasting legacies of Jerry Springer and programs like that?
Well, Jerry Springer has contributed to the birth of reality TV, and reality TV's influence lives beyond television and what you see from social media influencers. And the legacy of all that entertainment is that shock sells, people want sensation, and there's a lot of power to be had in capturing people's attention. Even if you're doing something that may be perceived as the lowest common denominator, just having people's attention is worth so much, not just in the entertainment industry, but in our politics. You can, rise all the way to the top if you just keep their attention.
For those of you just joining us, we are talking with Ross Benish, talking about his latest book, 1999, the year low culture conquered America and kickstarted our bizarre times. I'm so glad that in the order of things in your book, we proceed from Jerry Springer's to Beanie Babies. Because, I mean, there's just something, of course, so tawdry and I dare say, as far as I'm concerned, kind of repulsive about that whole Jerry Springer phenomenon, to swing then to something that on the surface is so much more wholesome, at a glance, completely harmless. And yet, the story of the Beanie Babies craze of the late 1990s is an extraordinary story of loss, heartbreaking loss for a whole lot of people. For anybody listening who maybe is not thoroughly acquainted with or has forgotten something about this, explain the scope of the Beanie Baby craze and why you have included this in your book.
So in the 90s, Beanie Babies began as $5 little stuffed plushy animals, like purple bears and brown dogs. They'd have the little tie tag in the shape of a heart with the poem and the animal's name on it. But they morphed into an instrument of financial speculation. People were so crazy about having all the Beanie Babies and getting the ones that they perceived to be rare, that a cottage industry of collectors sprung up, and some rare Beanie Babies were going for thousands of dollars. And the prices just kept going up and up. People were spending their life savings on them. There were fights over them. There was even a murder in West Virginia over Beanie Babies. There was a court case in Las Vegas where a couple was arguing about how to divide their Beanie Babies because they were worth so much at the time, and the judge just made them take turns picking them one after one. They have the Beanie Babies sprawled on the court floor, and they're just sitting there picking them. Beanie Babies spilled on the interstate in Atlanta and people were risking their lives to like run out there and grab them amid all the speeding cars. So it was market insanity, and it was like the pop culture version of what was going on in the economy at the time with the dot-com bubble. So I see this sort of market insanity pop up now with some of the new digital technologies, especially crypto-driven ones like NFTs, where they seem harmless, they seem even kind of cute and schlocky, but then you realize people are spending thousands of dollars on something that has no value, and eventually that catches up, because if the whole value is predicated just on reselling but not on people actually really wanting them or needing them, the market collapses, just like Dutch tulips did. The Beanie Baby market collapsed. Now they're worth $5 again. All those people who spent all
that,
the money are
if that.
Broken. Like, yeah.
Yeah, if worth that. One of the things that I also wanted to chime in and say, and I don't remember if you end up saying this in your book or not, or at least in so many words, but I think a lot of times when people think about that Beanie Baby craze, I mean, it just seems, you know, in retrospect, so stupid. I mean, how could an intelligent adult believe that these products mass produced by the millions that everybody is collecting could become, you know, precious collectibles that will be worth money? I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all, again, in retrospect. But at the time, so many people got caught up in this. And
That's crowd psychology.
Of course. I know somebody, I mean, personally, this is not anecdotal, I know somebody who actually is a member of Mensa. I mean, one of the most intelligent people I have ever known. And she was part of this craze. I mean, and I think wholeheartedly believed that she was finding a way to pay for her children's college education someday. And I can think of at least one faculty colleague at the college where I teach who was caught up in this same craze. So it was not just something in which the dim-witted among us were caught up or taken advantage of, but even really intelligent, well-read people who probably look back now in shock and horror at what they did, at how they fell for this. I mean, all kinds of people fell for this, and that's probably a really important cautionary tale for all of us.
Well, and if you go back to that time, there were price guides that were coming out that would say the prices are going to keep increasing and increasing. And for a little bit, that happened. So it seemed like the publishers of the price guides were onto something, because you did see a $5 toy go up for being hundreds of dollars, sometimes even thousands of dollars, and you want to get in on that. But many of the price guides publishers were collectors themselves who just wanted to see the prices go up, but that wasn't really clearly disclosed. A lot of that same stuff is happening now with meme coins. It's I'm sure it makes a lot of sense to people who invested in the Hawk Tua coin at the time. Maybe they thought they were going to get some return on their investment, but it just resulted in millions of dollars going to the people who put it out and the rest of the people being at home with nothing. But, you know, in 20 years, people will look at it differently than they did at the time of their purchase, of course.
Right, right. And, of course, you tell us the story of, among other things, counterfeit Beanie Babies being created and how in the wake of that, Beanie Baby authentication services sprang up. I mean, and people were paying good money to make sure that this next Beanie Baby they purchased was really and truly a Beanie Baby. And it's just amazing.
They pay four times the price of a Beanie Baby's retail value to get it authenticated.
Oh my gosh. It's interesting. I happen to own a tiny handful of Beanie Babies, not because I was collecting them or thinking anything about that they would be worth it someday, but some of them are colorful and really lovely and, you know, just easy to play with, easy to pop on the Christmas tree. But I have to say, every time, you know, I come across one of those Beanie Babies, I'm reminded all over again of kind of the heartbreak, which in so many ways that craze ultimately represented. Let's make sure that we take some time to talk about how the world of pro wrestling changed drastically in the late 1990s. And you share a term in this chapter that I'd never seen before reading your book. And if you look in certain dictionaries, you won't be able to look this word up and find it, although I think you tell us Merriam-Webster does now have this odd-looking word in the dictionary. Explain this word that I think is pronounced kayfabe and what that means.
Yep, that's the correct pronunciation. And kayfabe is basically pretending that something is genuine even though it is not, because you would rather believe in the story than in the truth of the matter. So you're suspending your disbelief for the sake of storytelling. And that's what pro wrestling is. When they say the ultimate warrior is from parts unknown, no one thinks that that roided up guy from the 80s actually came from some bizarre jungle. He's from Gold's Gym in California. But you want to believe that he's from parts unknown. That makes his character so much cooler. You know, just the way everything functions in wrestling, from the storytelling to the contests themselves, there is kayfabe because it's all scripted. It's not, a genuine athletic activity. But if you want to really enjoy the sport, you buy into it. You buy into all this stuff. And that's where we are with a lot of our messaging as a society. Mm. Whether you're looking at ACLU tweets or things the president says or some policies pushed by corporations that don't make sense on their face, we are suspending disbelief so that this entity that's pushing the message has a clear story to tell us. So I see kayfabe all around us. And, the 90s helped popularize that, because wrestling got so much more popular in the 90s. It was deregulated. They made it clear that the bouts were scripted. So people knew, this isn't legit, and they still wanted it anyways. Mm. And it became more popular than it ever had been before.
Right. And, of course, for generations, that was a carefully guarded secret. and for a lot of us who are youngsters, I mean, I was born in 1960, and I very much fell under the spell of pro wrestling on TV. And actually, while it was on TV for a while, roller derby. And I can remember, my parents being bewildered that I was falling for it. I mean, in believing all this rough play and so on. And I remember my mom or dad saying at one point, when this roller derby match is all done, they all go out for dinner together. And I remember looking at my mom or dad, whoever said that, and just thinking, you are so stupid. I can't believe you believe that. This is something I was very much caught up in. One of the things you explain in your book is that where we first see pro wrestling, in a sense, begin to admit this, had to do with money. Had to do with...
Oh, that's the only reason that they did it, because they want to get out of regulation.
And explain real quick what we're talking about there. I mean, what were they trying to evade? In what way did it make monetary sense for pro wrestling to begin to come clean about what it really was?
So there used to be state athletic commission fees tied to pro wrestling. You would have to have doctors there. You'd have to pay the state these license fees. And basically, wrestling was treated like boxing or any other athletic competition that you're going to put on. And Linda McMahon, who is now Secretary of Education nominee, she was the co-founder of the WWF, she argued successfully in many states that because it's scripted, we don't need to pay these fees. We don't need to pay these taxes. We're not like boxing at all. We're more like Broadway than we are like boxing. And by publicly admitting, hey, we're scripted, that pushed wrestling storytelling into a different type of era. It's called the Attitude Era, where, it's more about like shock and sex and violence than it is about the old school, cartoony form of wrestling. But the ultimate reason they did that was she got them out of a lot of taxes and a lot of regulations across dozens of states. Before, they had pretended that it was real, and if you pretend that it's real, you'll be treated like boxing. But if you admit to the con, you get your taxes cut. That was appealing to them.
Right, right. Well, at one point in this chapter, you say many people buy into what they emotionally want to believe. And I think one of the things you are suggesting in this book is that those words are every bit as true today as they were then. And those words are true not only when it comes to people who want to believe that pro wrestling is what it is and that the Iron Sheik is really from Iran and whatever. I mean, it goes beyond that, and it even goes to the political arena as well.
It definitely goes beyond that into the political arena and to the religious arena, too. You know, my family, most of them are big Trump supporters, and they don't actually think Mexico is going to build a wall and pay for it. But when he says that, they want to believe that he does, and they love that he's saying it. They suspend their, you know, disbelief because it's more fun and appealing to do so. They like the message behind it enough that they will give him the benefit of the doubt, the same way that I gave Vince McMahon the benefit of the doubt that Stone Cold Steve Austin was actually pummeling his boss and that it wasn't, you know, all choreographed by McMahon himself.
Mm. Well, we just have a minute or two left, so we do not get to explore the world of porn or the world of video games, but I want to give you a minute or so to talk about what you think might be an important lesson to take away or some word of hope in terms of, are we able to rise above where we are right now?
Well, a lesson to take away is that many of the trashiest aspects of our culture now still hold a lot of value and influence our world in ways that aren't super appreciated. So Jerry Springer or ICP may be mocked or scoffed, but they have something to tell us about the world that we're in. And then just a word of hope is that not every one of these developments is dire necessarily. If we look at reality TV and the world that Springer helped create, there's a lot of people now that have a voice, whether that's on social media or through a reality show, who weren't represented in pop culture at all before. So it may seem like silly or zany, but there's more people breaking into the entertainment field now than there used to be, and that's a field that is historically nepotistic and aristocratic, so there is some progress in that area.
Hmm. Well, the book is absolutely fascinating. And also quite entertaining, and I highly recommend it. Again, it's titled 1999, The Year Low Culture Conquered America and Kickstarted Our Bizarre Times, published by University Press of Kansas, the author, Ross Benesch. Ross Benesch, congratulations on a really terrific book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. It was great to talk with you.
Hey, it was awesome being on here again. I'd do it anytime.
Tomorrow on the morning show, in honor of Holocaust Remembrance Day, we're going to replay a portion of the interview, which I always say, if people ask me, what is your favorite interview of the thousands you've done over the last 30 years? I always respond, it's my interview with Alexandra Zapruder, the author and editor of an incredible book called Salvaged Pages, Young Writer's Diaries of the Holocaust, 15 such diaries, somewhat comparable to the famous diary of Anne Frank. That's tomorrow on the morning show. On Friday, we will preview two orchestral concerts coming up this weekend, one at UW Parkside, the other by the Racine Symphony, and we'll preview opening night of Head Over Heels, about to open on the campus of Carthage College. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today we will have cloudy skies with a 50% chance of light rain showers and possibly a thunderstorm at one point with a high of 73 degrees cooler near the lake. Partly cloudy and mild overnight with a low of 63. A mostly sunny day tomorrow with a high of 63 degrees. But clouds and rain return on Friday with a high of 66. It looks right now like we will have lovely sunny skies both Saturday and Sunday. and daytime highs ranging from the upper 50s to the low 60s. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva,